welcome back for a new episode of Design Cafe, where we like to have candid and deep conversations about UX design. We share about our thoughts and experience working as a designer in the tech industry. In this fourth season, we've decided to challenge ourselves by discussing some difficult taboo topics. So we'll cover things like mental health at work, dealing with toxic workplaces, and the challenges of career progression. Basically, topics that make you a bit uncomfortable to talk about, but are really important as they impact us all. I'm your co-host, Sandrine.
And I'm your co-host, Susan.
We intend to release a new episode every couple of weeks on a Friday. And in the meantime, if you'd like to hear a bit more about us, you can find us on Twitter at Design Cafe or on LinkedIn on Design Cafe. And we also have a website at designcafe.com. And if you'd like to support the podcast a little bit further, you can leave us a review on your podcast platform. And you can also buy us a coffee on buymeacoffee.com/designcafe. All right, so in this episode, we're going to cover a very difficult topic. We're going to touch on discrimination at work. So we are going to, I guess, talk a little bit about what it feels like to experience, for example, racism or sexism at work. I think these are probably the two types of discrimination that we are best placed to talk about with Susan. There's obviously tons of other types of discrimination, like ageism, discrimination regarding neurodivergence as well. I think these will be a little bit harder for us to cover since we're not experiencing themselves as individuals, but we might touch on examples maybe that we have observed, at least in the workplace ourselves. Okay, so Susan, maybe a good place to start would be, how would you describe what it is, what is discrimination, and what it is like, I guess, to be discriminated as well, especially in the workplace? Because I'm not sure everyone knows what exactly it means sometimes.
I think on the one hand, this can be a very academic topic, which I'm not remotely qualified to talk about. Like, I can't define discrimination in the proper, you know, academic or whatever definition of what it is. So the best I can do is talk about it from my own perspective of what discrimination is, both as someone who's experienced discrimination and is experiencing discrimination, and also just as a person who has worked in workplaces and observed discrimination. So for me, discrimination is when you are treated differently based on any sort of aspect of your individual self. So that could be, yeah, age, like you mentioned, your gender, religion, disability, non-disability, race, all of these things. And you're treated differently and differently in a way that is unfavorable. So you're losing out on something, or you're disadvantaged in some way because of one or more of these characteristics. It's a total side tangent. I suppose is that there's positive discrimination as well, which is, you know, sort of the opposite, that you're treated differently, but you're being elevated on account of some of your characteristics that are viewed or perceived as very positive, even though, I don't know, let's say blonde people are positively discriminated because blonde hair colors, this is so banal, but blonde hair colors, you know, like a positive thing.
So, I have a completely different understanding of positive discrimination, actually.
Oh, yeah?
For me, I understood it that you're going to when you positively discriminate, is that, let's say, you're going to be like, oh, we want to hire more black people, for example, in our team.
So, affirmative action.
Yeah, so, for me, that would be, I guess, positive discrimination in the sense that you're treating people differently based on their race, but let's say you're treating them more favorably in this particular instance, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I completely agree with that as well. I think that's also a definition, a way you can define positive discrimination. So it's sort of, you're doing an underrepresented group a disservice by treating them as oof, this is horrible, but like tokens, basically, like, oh, we need more women, so let's hire this person because she's a woman, or the affirmative action stuff. So that's problematic as well.
I find it interesting. Sorry, it reminds me of a conversation I have with friends actually around positive discrimination. I can see how it's problematic, but also, do you think it can help balance out a bit in some instances?
I don't think there's a right answer to this. I think it has... There are countries that have used explicit affirmative action practices to try and increase equality. And I think the political way I can talk about this is that there are pros and cons. There are pros and cons. Like, you know, it's a way of trying to improve equity in, for example, in the workplace. But then there are downsides as well. I'm being very careful talking about this, not because I feel like I have controversial opinions about this, it's more because it's such a nuanced topic. But some of the downsides is that for example, let's say I get hired into a role because for several reasons, one of them is that because I'm a woman, I would actually worry that my colleagues who are men would think that I'm less qualified than I actually am, because they will be thinking that, oh, Susan was just hired because she's a woman. And then that dynamic, that fear I have of their perception, maybe it's real, maybe it's not, it would also influence how I perform at work. So yeah, it's a very thorny subject.
Yeah, I find it really interesting actually, because for me, there's, especially in the workplace, there's discrimination on entry, and then there's discrimination, I guess, in the actual experience of working there. And I think, as you said, like, was positive discrimination might help you, you know, finally get in, which is a big step, by the way. I do think, like, it can help in that regards. But as you said, then it might actually exacerbate the discrimination in the post-hiring experience of that employee. And that is usually problematic, because that person might have to go the extra mile to even prove themselves even further. So yeah.
It's quite complex, I think. But yeah, to further add to my definition of discrimination, I also feel like there's you can think about discrimination as direct and indirect, or explicit and implicit discrimination as well. So direct discrimination are sort of the obvious ones that come to mind when you think about discrimination at work. I think, for example, that women get paid less than men. That's a very kind of direct, obvious, explicit type of discrimination. And there are multiple examples of this. But then there's indirect discrimination as well, which I feel is even... not more problematic. it's not that one is worse than the other, but it's because it's indirect, it's so much harder to see. So an example of that is, for example, if you have social events that only ever involve drinking alcohol, or they're only ever after work, or they're only ever after work and involve drinking alcohol, then you can be discriminating against people who don't drink for whatever reason, for example, religious reasons, or you're discriminating against people who don't have the capacity or the resources to socialize with their company after work. So those are a bit harder to spot, but I think if you're on the receiving end of those types of discriminations, you feel it as well. And I'm not just hypothesizing. I can speak from my own experience that it's those kind of murky, implicit types of discriminations that are a bit iffy, or quite iffy, because I feel like it's too easy to just say, this woman is being paid the same as this man, so therefore we have no gender discrimination here, and therefore this is not a place that discriminates against women, for example. But then there are other more implicit ways of discriminating against women in the workplace. For example, have a think about the leadership team. If you're in a department with 50% men and 50% women, you can sort of pat yourself on the back and say that, oh, we're equal here, we're not discriminating based on gender. But then what if all the seniors and all the leads are men and all the midweights and all the juniors are women? It's like, is that, what is happening there? What kind of biases and implicit systemic issues are happening there? So yeah, a long way of definition of discrimination, but I think it's there's so many layers to it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think those silent layers, as you said, with implicit discrimination is, I think it's a lot harder to rally people behind them when they occur. Because as you said, like with, I guess, the most obvious example of sexism in the workplace, which is the unequal pay. It's on paper, right? You can easily see it. It's quite tangible. And it's a lot easier to question it. But when, as you said, it's like biases against individuals, like I think we've all experienced them of like, I don't know, sometimes it's just a bias of expecting maybe women to be less reliable or I don't know, there's someone saying someone is being emotional and that's being perceived as a bad thing and that's targeting a female individual, for example. And these are kind of like small, sometimes representation of what discrimination can be like. They come from biases that we have, they come from just societal perspectives, I guess, that we've, or societal concept that we've kind of embedded in our, you know, way of being and doing things over time. And unless you have people actively questioning their biases and trying to really like reconsider sometimes their approach, it can be really, really hard. And you can't expect everyone in the workplace to be introspecting into their own behavior. So I think often people suffer a lot from this. And I find it's really hard to even sometimes prove that discrimination occurred because it's so silent. And often there are, I find what is really hard with implicit discrimination is that it really appears like no big deal to people that are privileged or don't get discriminated. And often there will appear to be a single event or a single occurrence, when actually often the person kind of experience it several times. But let's say if you take them in isolation, they really don't appear like a big thing and a big, yeah, they don't appear like a big event basically. It's more when you put it all together that sometimes you can identify a pattern or how you can actually see how that burdens a person over time. But I feel like that's quite hard to do sometimes for individuals. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. It's these individual instances of implicit discrimination. They're so small and nuanced and really hard for privileged people, like you say, to detect. Because it's not the obvious ones, like, you know, someone saying a racial slur or someone, you know, obviously being paid less for doing the same job on account of their gender, for example. But it's the aggregation, as you say, of all these lots and lots of, let's call them paper cuts of implicit discrimination that builds up to what is systemic discrimination quite often. And I tend to think about this as what is the default status quo expected behavior or presentation of a person, like what is in a workplace, a given workplace, what is the sort of default human characteristics in that workplace that is being expected, rewarded, and so on. And in so many workplaces I've been, the sort of default expected characteristic has been typically an unmarried, single, white male. I'm taking this to the extreme, but someone who can go to the pub after work, someone who can work late, someone who's able-bodied, someone who can like do all these things. And if, and then so if you're not fitting into that default, then you're losing out on some of the workplace, what am I going to call it? I don't know, some of the advantages you get from just being fitting comfortably into that default. So I'm not sure if I'm making any sense, but as someone who hasn't been fitting into any default in a workplace, I have never ever worked in a place where the default is an Asian, East Asian woman, you know, like I've never been in that workplace. Like, so I've always felt like I've had characteristics that put me outside of the default. I also have lots of characteristics that put me inside of the privileged elite, you know, like I'm for example able-bodied, etc. But it's, yeah, it's sort of like I guess it, for me, it comes down to questioning what is the default, what is the status quo, what is the norm, basically, what is the norm in a workplace, and what happens to the people who don't fit into that norm. How do we talk to them? How do we treat them? How do we value them? How do we implement workplace practices and social events and opportunities around all these characteristics?
Yeah, I think what pains me is that what you've described, when you don't fit in, it's not that you just miss out on a great social experience with your colleagues. You miss out on building network. You miss out on getting to know key individuals in the company who can then create further opportunities for you. And I think that's really where the problem is. If you obviously constantly create those occasions for the same type of people, you would tend to interact with the same type of people, and then therefore some people will miss out. I find that it's also a vicious circle, because if you miss out and then you get passed on opportunities, you might also not be able to show what you can do. And then that can also be then used against you to say, well, you've never been able to demonstrate or prove X, Y, Z. And actually, if you never really get to access opportunities that challenge you, fit your strength, and boost your motivation, it's quite unlikely that you'll be able to show your best of your ability. And yes, you can work hard and all of this, and yes, but you know, it's still not the same as being placed on the opportunities that suits you best. And some people that are privileged in the workplace will automatically get those opportunities, because they are first thought when people think about who should we place on those projects and that sort of thing. And, you know, I think that creates that circle where if you can't demonstrate your best or you're not on high profile projects, then you will basically automatically be thought as a second class player or something like that. And that's really damaging. And then you're actually even passed by even more for further opportunities, promotions and that sort of thing. And I find it really sad, and I have seen it at times happening, and I don't particularly know how to break that circle when I see it happen, especially if it happens not necessarily to me, but to others as well. I think there's always that question of like, you observe something, how can you take action in a way that doesn't also place you at risk, right? Because these are really challenging conversations to have at work. And companies tend to take them quite seriously, obviously, sometimes for self-protection purposes, obviously. So yeah, it's a very tricky one.
It's exactly that, I feel, with what you comment about opportunities, that if you don't fit into the norm and the status quo person in the workplace and you sit a bit outside, you have to work so much harder. And that's because the systems that serve these opportunities, the system is built based on whatever the default norm person is. I keep calling this a default norm person is, even though I clearly in my head have the image of a white man. So maybe I should just call it what it is. Like in most workplaces, that is the norm. Yeah. So when you have reward systems and opportunity systems that are being historically shaped and designed by these people, white men typically, then it's obviously easier for them to rise up and get opportunities, and it's much harder for those who don't fit into that shape to get those opportunities. And so you just have to work so much harder to get to the same place as someone who is a bit more advantaged than you, or appear more advantaged than you. And yeah, it's a really hard circle to break out of. And I think part of the problem is that because we have so many explicit or practices in the workplace against explicit discrimination, I think it's easy for a lot of people who aren't victims of this as much, it's easy for a lot of them to say, oh, we're an equal practices workplace. We pay women the same as men. We pay white people the same as non-white people. Problem solved, nothing to worry about. And then it's all those invisible layers that are felt quite visibly to those of us who and which aren't felt as much by those who aren't affected by it. And then, you know, it's another vicious circle of the people who decide these things tend to be the people in privileged decisions, and, you know, so they will never see it. What can one do about it? More diverse leadership is always my mantra. What I think sucks so much, and I feel very strongly about this, and I know it's a good step forward, but what I think sucks so much is that in an effort to improve diversity and inclusion in the workplace and mitigate discrimination, companies hire diverse people into positions, but they tend to be like the junior mid positions, which, yes, is better than hiring. It's better than not hiring these people, but it needs to be in leadership. You need to have diverse leadership.
I agree. Yeah. And it's, again, it's a vicious circle, right? Because I think people in this position also sometimes might be a bit harder to find. First, because, as you said, what we qualify as a good leader often is what a cis white male would fit perfectly. So often we have that bias of discarding qualities that a more diverse person would bring. So sometimes we can't really identify these people as a leader, even though they would be a great leader. And also, I think there's less diverse people in our industry simply because it's been harder for them to enter the industry in the first place. But it's a shame because, as you said, if we were to have more diverse leaders, we would also get more diverse people through the door. We would have representatives that would inspire young people, you know, across the world to kind of just enter the industry and feel like, okay, yeah, I can do this, you know, like this is accessible to me. And again, you know, I think for me that's a circle that feeds itself, because the less representation you have in those, the less accessible it looks like, and the less young people you'll see enter the door, and the less support you'll find as well for those that do make it through the door. I think this is real, that, you know, they get, sometimes you don't know what kind of support to give them simply because there's just a bias and a lack of understanding of how to best support them, how to give them the right opportunities and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's another like catch 22 chicken and egg thing. Are those the same? I don't know. I'm gonna go with it. Where, you know, of course it's hard for people to hire diverse people into leadership because there aren't many candidates, etc., etc. But then for me, observing things, I often think it's also a bit of a network, like social network problem, where I see all these white cis men leaders who complain that, or who have good intentions and want to hire more diversity into leadership, but oh, it's so hard, they're so hard to find. But I wonder how many of them think about their own social network and how much that has to say in how they shape their leadership team and their hiring practices, because there's not, it's not, you look around on the street, we're not lacking women and non-white people and people with disabilities and people who are neurodivergent and young people and old people. Like, they exist. There are lots of them out there. I think part of the problem is you kind of just look within your circle. And if your circle are mostly people who look like you, then yeah, so of course it's going to be hard for you to find these people. To put it bluntly, I see so many of these status quo default norm leaders complain that it's a pipeline problem and they're so hard to find. And then I kind of like look at who they interact with, who they socialize with, who's in their network, what other leaders they hang out with, and they all look like them. And so I'm just kind of like scratching my head. It's like, why don't you diversify your social network? It'll be a bit easier maybe to fix that pipeline problem if you diversify your friends, and not just friends, but, you know, who you interact with and which communities you engage with. I don't know. I find it so shocking, but at the same time, totally not shocking that some of these leaders can go to events, conferences, panels, etc., that are all white or all white men, or, you know, incredibly homogenous, and not question it, and not question where they are and which network they're in. And it's sort of like if a conference or an event is incredibly homogenous, if they're all white, for example, then it's one of the first things I notice. And I immediately go like, I don't feel comfortable here and I don't want to be here. I notice I'm getting very like worked up about this topic. But I suppose my point with this is it's so hard to acknowledge a problem if you don't. It's so hard to fix a problem if you don't see it as a problem in the first place because of your position.
But I guess the beauty of privilege is that you don't realize what life is like without that privilege. I think, you know, it has happened to me as well personally, to one day open my eyes and realize how some people that, you know, didn't look like me, or were from a different race, or I don't know, had disabilities and what kind of challenges they were facing. And, you know, for a long time, I was completely oblivious to it because it never impacted me. It's never been a problem to me. It's never been a blocker. And as you said, my network, when I was, you know, as I was growing up, going through uni, it was mostly white people around me as well. Obviously, you know, like there was, obviously, the question of sexism for me sometimes that was coming at play, but otherwise, you know, like I never sometimes needed to open my eyes further. And I think that's the hardest, is how first do you get people to acknowledge the problem? How do you get them to care about the problem? And how do you get them to take real action that actually is efficient as well? Because sometimes, you know, it's not enough to just say, yeah, I care about this. But then there's also like, how do you actually action on it? And yeah, I think sometimes all of these things are very disconnected. But I agree, sometimes it's very disheartening to be in a room full of men and they are like talking about diversity like it's been achieved. And it is really not. And a lot of people are thinking it. Yeah, I mean, it happened to me in a work event where some people were praising their diversity, and I've heard actually some people around me saying, contesting, being like, actually, they're not diverse, and pointing directly the fact that they were mostly white men, and were like, why are they saying they're diverse when it's mostly white men? And that's a clear thing where, again, that's in our playing, where these people are still quite oblivious of the problem. And yeah, it's always goes back to the question of like, how do you do it? How do you bring that conversation in without obviously offending? Because I think sometimes these people have good intentions, and they intend to be good human beings, and they are probably trying to fight back their biases in some manner, but somehow they're not quite there yet. I don't know if you've managed to have a successful conversation around that kind of topic.
Yes, I have. Well, it hasn't been like a conversation I had with another individual. It's more like conversations that happened in a workplace context, which I felt was, well, there's one example I have in mind, which is really sad because I don't have that many examples. I think I mostly have one. And we had really successful conversations around this topic. But I think I need to contrast that example with all the other examples which weren't successful. Just as context for this. So when you talk about how people praise how diverse they are, when you use that as an example, I have heard that so many times, I've observed and heard that so many times. I've been in these settings where in a workplace context, people are proud of their diversity and proud of their equality, and we don't discriminate here, and look at our counts and our numbers. And it's usually things like counting the number of women in leadership. I know I just made this point about diversity in leadership, but, you know, kind of counting, oh, we have so many women in leadership, and it's the same number as men. But and then I'm just sitting there, it's like, but you're all white, for example. Or we have so many, we have an equal number of, yeah. yeah, it's sort of, so are you not seeing all the other bits, the intersectional parts of this? Or, yeah, like my previous example of, we are so gender diverse in this team because we're half and half, and then all the seniors are men and all the juniors are women. Oh, I could go on and on with examples. Anyway, my point is, I think if you're overly praising yourself in the workplace context, overly praising yourself on being equal and having achieved non-discrimination and having achieved equality in the workplace, you're completely delusional. Completely delusional. Like, it does not exist. The world is discriminating. The world is discriminating. And so if you're patting yourself on the back thinking, oh, we've achieved it in this team or in this company, then gosh, you're such a huge part of the problem. So to go back to your question about, like, have I had successful conversations about this? And that one example I have in mind is when the company and the leadership, the very privileged leadership, was the opposite of that. They initiated lots of conversations in the company, owning up to the company's problems. We have problems here. We have racial inequality, we have gender inequality, we have socioeconomic inequality. That's another one that maybe people don't think about that often. But if you're hiring, for example, and you look at CVs and you think favorably of people, yeah, who, number one, went to university. Yeah. And number two, went to good universities, and you favor them, yeah, that is discrimination. And I'm like I'm elevating myself so much, I don't even know why I'm pointing this out, but I really despise that. And I'm someone who went to university and went to the fairly good one, so, you know, it's, and I think I've had unfair advantages because I have that on my CV, and I'm pretty sure someone's, let's say, positively discriminated me in one of those definitions because of that. So anyway, yeah. So that example, that company that looked, where the leadership looked closely at themselves and their discriminatory practices, and openly and humbly started those conversations with the rest of the company, that led to so much progress. It's not like, oh, they achieved equality at the end of this, but it led to so much progress. I'm not going to go into detail, but there were so many good initiatives and ongoing practices and behavior changes and attitude changes and value changes that came out of those conversations, where leadership actually had the self-awareness and introspection to understand that there was discrimination in the workplace. So yeah, it's, I think that's the difference, basically. I'm oversimplifying this, but do the people in power have the self-awareness to understand that there is discrimination, whether they like it or not, or do they not have that self-awareness?
Yeah, absolutely, that's a big one. I think in regards to the leadership as well, and particularly with gender biases on that one. I think a lot of the time, sometimes we would be, they would be praising diversity leadership because they have a woman, but often that woman would be holding a position that is over-indexing, let's say, in women. So, for example, chief people officer is, I've often seen a woman holding that type of leadership. And for me, I will see real progress when I start seeing more CPOs, more CEOs as women. Like, you know, like I would say, I don't like it's obviously an achievement for women that have, you know, reached the chief people officer title. So I by no means want to say that it's no mean feat or anything. But I feel like positions where there's business leadership required. So I would think more of COO, CEO and CPO kinds of function, or CFO as well. I think all of this have been still really like overly indexing in cis white men. And yeah, I don't know why some people still think that it's basically just an achievement when they see there's some women in leadership, but they're yet there's still no women in actually like in leadership position that usually actually don't have women in, if you know what I mean. I'm explaining this very badly, but I find it's quite frustrating because for me it's still not a sign of change, basically.
Yeah, and just to add an additional layer of complexity to this, so for example, I think a CFO, which is traditionally a white male dominated role. I don't have numbers in front of me, but I dare say that a CFO probably usually earns a lot more than a chief people officer as well, which is typically a woman coded, a feminine coded role, which adds this complexity of like, why do organizations reward and value masculine coded roles higher than feminine coded roles as well? So yeah, just another addition of this.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you backtrack it to what values I guess are attached to each of these functions, right? The people function is a lot more seen with the nurturing aspect, which by default a feminine type of figure will come to mind with it. Even though obviously there's tons of challenges in the people teams they have to deal with and all this, but it's by default, I think the perception of the values it's attached to will be a lot more feminine in our mind, at least. And I think there's that bias is there. Whilst when you think finance, you think a lot more, I don't know, logic type of persona and that sort of thing. And for me, I still have a male figure appearing in my mind, which is crazy after all this time. And, you know, it's pretty telling. The picture of the person we see in those roles is often not anything else but a white man. So yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Obviously, this episode is not meant to be a massive tirade against white men, but I think some of them can be amazing allies as well in the workplace. And I was wondering, actually, Susan, how can someone be a good ally in the workplace and help support others and also help maybe sometimes change the workplace to be less discriminative?
Yeah, that's a great question and a great angle on it as well. Just, yeah, for the record, I know many amazing white men, so it's not an anti-white men thing. Oh God, this episode, I'm going to be cancelled because of this. How can people be good allies? Luckily, I've observed people be great allies in the workplace by creating space for people who are typically discriminated against and people who are typically underrepresented. Creating space by letting them talk, creating space by inviting them into rooms, giving them opportunities, making these people more visible. It could be things like letting them present more often at all hands and other company events and that sort of thing, just creating space for them. Good allies also create more social empathy or organizational empathy for people who are discriminated against by either taking their, like, bringing in their perspective or letting them speak for their own perspective. So kind of challenging when the default perspective is the, let's say, the privileged white men perspective or the loudest voice perspective.
I think for me, I've seen, especially if you're a manager, I think you have really a key position to become a strong ally. And the ones that I've seen that have been very successful at this are the people that really bothered to get to know their report. So first, they would obviously be super in tune with diverse hiring, but they wouldn't just stop there. They would also really like make sure they get to know everyone in their team, no matter who they are. They would get to know them. They would get to know what their strengths are. They will get to build empathy, compassion, and just know how to support these people and tailor their approach. And based on that, basically, they would make their own opinion of these people and be able to really advocate for them in a way that suits their strengths and really like focus on the individual based on how they got to know them. And focus on the work they do. So really focus on the output and the quality of that based on the constraints they've been having in that particular project as well. And really just focus on that and identify their potential and then basically know how they could do a lot better, maybe in a different opportunity, different project and that sort of thing. And obviously it sounds like common sense, but a lot of people don't do that.
Common sense is not so common.
No. So yeah, I think people that I've seen have been good allies or have been described as being good allies. I've noticed that's something they do.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And to add to it, I think good allies are also simply, maybe not so simply, good at calling things out. Mm-hmm. Because especially if you're an ally in a privileged position, it's relatively, I'm not saying it's easy for anyone, unless you're that type of personality, but it's relatively easier for those people to call out discriminatory language, discriminatory behavior, discriminatory workplace practices when they see it. So if you see it, say it. Oh God. So if you see something that looks like discrimination and smells like discrimination and sounds like discrimination, then call it out. And I think you're going to get other people to also go like, oh yeah, that is true. I never noticed that. Or I completely agree. Or people who kind of quietly thought that they saw discrimination, but didn't dare to speak up, maybe because they were worried for whatever reason. So yeah, it can be hard, I think, even if you are in a privileged position. But I honestly think if you're a good ally, you call things out when you see them.
I agree with that. I think what is hard sometimes is that typically environments that have a lot of discrimination are not particularly the safest environment as well. So it's sometimes hard for the people who want to be allies as well to not also obviously suffer consequences, which will then could drive them out of the workplace, which is obviously also something that everyone can suffer from. So it's kind of tricky in those situations, but I do agree that at least acknowledging that it happens sometimes is just validating. It's a massive step forward sometimes for the person who's dealing with this, because often I think people can be quite invalidated and sometimes gaslighted in the situation. So just validating is already, I think, quite a lot. And then obviously, if you can do more, if you can call it out to someone that will be supportive and it's safe to do so, and I think it's obviously the next step to take.
And it builds trust as well. If I see someone, a strong ally in a privileged position who's calling things out or validating things rather than pretend it doesn't exist, then I trust that person more. Yeah. I trust that person so much more, and I'm drawn to that person as someone I can confide in and someone I can share my experiences and observations with. And that's how you build a stronger allyship in these workplace contexts as well. Whereas the opposite is when I see someone who's invalidating discriminatory practices, who's invalidating them by, for example, like we mentioned earlier, is said that, oh, we're so diverse or we're so equal. I don't trust that person because I don't feel like they are at that stage yet where they have the ability to take my perspective, for example, yeah, or take someone else's perspective.
I think sometimes what can be blocking from, obviously, I think you can always validate, but I think sometimes what can prevent you from taking action as well is that sometimes you don't know if it was discrimination or if it was an isolated event or if it was just a person being on a strange day. You know what I mean? It's like, when and how can you safely, I guess, determine that it was discrimination? And then, and as well, sometimes I feel like we make, okay, it might sound a bit strange for me to say that, but sometimes we make a big deal of a discriminatory act. And I think actually we had, in one of my workplace, we had someone talking about that around how we all have biases, and it's fine to have them because you're human, so you will therefore have them. And if sometimes we de-escalate the fact that you have discriminated in the past and you may do again so in the future, if you can at least be aware that you have a bias and a tendency to discriminate, then therefore you're likely to call yourself out or be open to someone calling yourself out on it when it happens so that you can do better in the future, and you can also obviously resolve the situation with the individual who has received your discrimination, if that makes sense. But I feel like something, because we make such a big deal of it, we also make a thing we don't talk about. If you know what I mean, like, it is a big deal that it's happening and it's a problem to tackle. But also, because we become somewhat infuriated at the person who does it, it feels like the person has, it's better not to talk about it. It becomes a taboo, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's so important to talk about things exactly so that it doesn't become a taboo. And so just to add to what I was saying earlier about the importance of calling things out to be a good ally, I suppose what I was thinking when I talked about it earlier was call things out when you see it in others. But an even better step, and this is even harder, but an even better step is to publicly call it out when you see it in yourself. And I've seen that, well, once, which is really sad, but there's one time I can remember where I've observed that, and it was the most amazing thing, and it just kind of reinforces that trust building and good allyship thing and every, like, humility and leadership, etc., etc., that we've been talking about. And it was when a white cis man leader, very high up in the organization, publicly to absolutely everyone in the company, called himself out and acknowledged that he had said something discriminatory to someone else in the company, and apologized with no excuses, just said, like, that was, I'm not going to say what kind of discrimination it was, but like, let's add the ist at the end of it. And he was just saying, like, that was something ist of me. And yeah, I shouldn't have done that. And that's incredibly admirable that someone can call it out in themselves as well.
Yeah. I mean, you see, for me, it's amazing. And it goes back to that previous episode where we were at calling ourselves brave for talking about mental health and that sort of thing. And I feel like it's kind of still a bit sad that we recognize that as an act of bravery when it should be okay. Like, we're all going to blunder. You know, some things are new to us. You know, I think for me, like, sometimes you're going to make a mistake, and the best you can do is learn how the community you've made a mistake about likes to be, I guess, acknowledged back or something like that. Sometimes there's some guidance around. I've seen some colleagues in my workplace, for example, talking about they're non-binary, so they explain what if you make a mistake in the pronouns that you use, for example, with them. And they would say, oh, well, I actually like that you correct yourself that way, or you acknowledge it that way, or that sort of thing. And that's helpful, because you can address the issue, you can apologize, you can excuse yourself, whatever. And you can move on, and you can do better the next time. And I think the more, obviously, you, sometimes you might make a few mistakes, but then over time, you're going to integrate that new way of doing things, and it's going to become part of your day to day, and you're not even going to double think it next time, and it's just going to be intuitive. So yeah, I just wish it wasn't a brave thing anymore, and just a normal thing to say, oh, sorry, I that's sexist of me to say this, isn't it? Sorry, let's move on. Or like, let me rephrase this. Or like, you know, like, it's, I feel like it shouldn't be such a big thing, basically.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, of course, that's the end goal. That's yeah. The outcome you want to get to. But
a long way. Way there.
As a stepping stone, exactly. It's about acknowledging that the problem exists, acknowledging that I'm racist. I have, like, I could do an episode on my internalized racism and other types of racism and sexism, and, you know, and because, yeah, like, we're human and we make mistakes, and acknowledging that that a problem exists is so important in order for us to get to that outcome.
Yeah, I agree. I think with the making the having bias is not a big deal, I think it's important to also not excuse yourself as well, obviously. Like, I think it might be easy to be like, when you look at it more from a scientific perspective around, or is it scientific? I don't really know. I guess it's the way our brain are formed and how we social creatures, and we have biases obviously given to us through our culture and our upbringing and all this. It's super easy to excuse yourself being like, well, I was raised this way, this is what I know. And being like, what do you want me to do about it? You know, if you know what I mean. So I think it's also important not to cross that line as well, of starting being complacent with who you are, what you've known, what you've gone through, and be open to, yeah, challenge yourself and question yourself.
Yeah, but also, I completely agree with that, but also I think it's important not to attach shame to things. So you're not a bad person for saying or doing a sexist thing, or saying or doing a racist thing. We're all in this very discriminatory system. We're all in this messed up system. So I think it's also important not to go so far as to shame yourself for making mistakes. And it's a middle ground.
I agree with that. I think, yeah, because I think if you shame yourself as well, it might prevent you from trying to put more effort into opening your mind and getting to know others and all this. But yeah, it's a fine line. Like, how... Sorry, it's a whole other topic. But at what point does, I guess... Because, you know, there's some people that are just quite happy to be discriminative. And they will be like, yeah, I'm fine being a racist, for example. How do you become like this?
Oh, God. It's a whole other conversation.
But for me, it's like that, you know, if I see it as a pendulum of someone who's making a mistake and trying and failing at times, but trying to catch themselves or being open to that other extreme of someone being completely like either unaware or even happy to be the way they are and continuing to actually act in a discriminative manner to others on almost on purpose at times.
I don't know if this is the right answer. I think I'm just speaking from the perspective of how I cope and my own coping mechanism. But the way I confront these situations is I put more of my energy into the pendulum swing towards the people who have the ability and self-awareness to see their mistake, see the problem, and take active steps themselves to improve and fix and correct, and see that they have the power to make small changes that build up to bigger changes. I think that's another point. Like, you have some people who, see that racism and sexism and ableism and ageism are problems, but they're sort of like, oh well, that's the world, can't do anything about it, I can't do it, you know, that, or who put the burden on the underrepresented people to fix the problem, to educate them and to fix the problem, and don't see that they have the power in themselves to fix it as well. Sorry, going off on a tangent. My point is I try to put my energy towards the people who can practice active anti-discrimination and who have the self-awareness to see how they can be part of fixing the problem. And I try to not put so much energy into convincing the other pendulum swing people that things need to be fixed, because I guess it's that age old, some people can't be, how do you say it? Some people can't be fixed, some people can't be, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, a good rule of thumb is to, it's not your responsibility to fix, yeah, others, right? I think it's healthier to, as you said, focus on people that do want to actively take their responsibility and feel accountable to change, as opposed to spend a lot of energy trying to change someone's mind, I guess, who has no intention of acknowledging the impact that they're having. I guess sometimes it's like, it's their responsibility, I guess, to put the pendulum go back to the other way, right? I guess maybe you can just say what you have to say and then just leave it up to them to absorb it. But it might just go through one ear and come out the other way, the other one, and that's about it. But that's not something you can control, right?
Yeah, you have a finite amount of energy and emotional resources to deal with this. And so, my go-to approach is to protect and preserve my energy to the high impact, high value areas of this, and not spend so much energy on things that sap me.
Okay, so I think we've done a good tour around the discrimination topic. I know we haven't really touched on, obviously, all of the kinds of that discrimination that can affect people in the workplace, but hopefully this conversation has still brought a bit of light and helped a little bit. Thank you for listening. If you wanna hear a bit more about us, you can still find us on Twitter at Design Cafe, and we also have a website at designcafe.com. We will be back in a couple of weeks for another episode. Thanks for listening.